Thanks, Steve. Thanks, Anna. Shall I pray for us? Father, as we come to your word this morning, we want to be people who have ears to hear. We want our hearts to be in line with your heart. We want our wills to be in line with your will for our lives. And so I pray that as your word goes out this morning, as your word promises, it will not return empty. So, Spirit of God, please would you take that word and teach us and rebuke us and correct us and encourage us and inspire us. Please do a mighty work in this place. In Jesus' name. Amen. When you know the future, it changes what you do now, doesn't it? Look at that phrase. Knowing the future changes what you do today. That's true, isn't it? I remember when I was 18 years old, I got a phone call from my godmother who asked me to go and visit her. My godmother was a larger-than-life lady, and when I walked through the door, I knew that something was wrong. And she sat me down and she said, "Paul, I've got cancer. They've given me 6 months maximum." And there were no tears, but we had a wonderful time, and she talked to me. She gave this dorky 18-year-old some advice on life, and she gave me some of her stuff. And she spent the next 6 months just giving stuff to people that she loved and telling people that she loved them. She knew that she had 6 months left, and so she used that time wisely. So when you know something's going to happen in the future, it changes what you do today, doesn't it? If the people in the Twin Towers knew that the plane was going to hit, they would not have gone to work that morning, would they? If the people on the beach knew the tsunami was going to hit, they wouldn't have gone to the beach that morning. Or if the people knew that MH370 would disappear, they wouldn't have gone on the plane that day. If you knew that your health was going to fail in 2 years' time, you might do things differently today. If you knew you were going to meet the person you're going to marry 2 weeks before you head overseas for that dream job, you might not have said yes to the dream job overseas. If you knew exactly what was going to happen in the future, it would change what you do today, wouldn't it? Do you agree with me? Yep. But the problem is we don't know what's going to happen in the future, do we? Who of us here knows exactly what's going to happen next month or next year or in 5 years' time? We often live as though we do, don't we? We often plan and plot as though we're in control and we know exactly what's going to happen next month and next year and in 5 years' time. And we're obsessed with our superannuation and what's the best scheme to go in and what's the best commission rate we're going to avoid and all this kind of stuff. And we just assume that, of course, we're going to live till we retire and then get old and our health will fail and then we'll die at a ripe old age. A risk analysis was once asked about planning or financial advice. He said, I know the prime age to buy your first property. I know the best time to buy your shares. I know the best place to do your currency exchanges. I know the best superannuation scheme. And he talked about 10 minutes, so he talked about all the best ways to save your retirement. And the interviewer said to him, "Have you ever thought about the possibility that you might actually die young?" There's absolute silence. He'd never thought about the fact that he didn't know exactly how long he had on this earth. See, we plot and plan as though we're in control, but we don't know what the future holds. None of us do. I reckon that's why we're so shocked by, the premature death of a celebrity or a friend who told they've got cancer in their 40s or 50s. We're just shocked by it. We just assume that we're going to live to a ripe old age. So the only facts in life are that we've got a birthday, yes, and we've got a death day. One day we'll meet our Maker. We know that's going to happen. I want to say, friends, knowing that fact that you're going to meet your Maker, it should change the way that you live today. And that's our parable this morning. It's been described as one of the most difficult in Luke. It's quite tricky because all the characters are flawed, bad, dodgy, dishonest. Let me just be clear. God is not saying be deceitful and scheming and embezzling and egotistical just like this man. He's not saying that. But he is saying when you know what's going to happen in the future, you will act shrewdly now. Verse 1, Jesus is talking to his disciples, to followers of Jesus. He's teaching his disciples what it means to live now in light of their future. But do you spot who's listening in verse 14? The Pharisees, who were lovers of money, were listening to all these things and scoffing. That word literally means they turn their nose up. They're scoffing because they love their money. That money is their God. They're living now for their money. So Jesus is rebuking the Pharisees and teaching his disciples. And the scheme of Luke, in the context of Luke, what have you had in chapter 15? You've got the prodigal son who squandered all his wealth now. He had no sight of his future at all. And after this parable, you've got the rich man and Lazarus, this rich man who had everything in this earth but gave no thought to eternity, and he ends up in hell. And Jesus is basically saying, if you're a follower of me now, then think about what you say and what you do and who you relate to and how you relate to and your priorities and your decisions and your finance management to show that you really have grasped that you're living for eternity. That's our big point. Act shrewdly now in light of your future. Let's look at the parable. First one is a rich man. So a kind of property tycoon. He's got lots of land, lots of property. He's employed a manager in verse 1. So he's really wealthy. Someone to look after his assets. Someone to handle his finances. But we're told in verse 1 that this manager was squandering his possessions, just like the prodigal son. He's wasteful. He's irresponsible. He's kind of the manager here. You know, you'd never do this, would you? The lavish lunches on someone else's account, or flying business cars just because you can, or five-star hotels just because you can, someone else is paying for it. So he's abusing his position, if you want. And then the rich man finds out in verse 1. And so he calls his manager in verse 2 and says, "What's this I hear about you? How dare you squander my money? Give an account of your management because you're fired. You can no longer be my manager." I reckon the big mistake is in verse 2. The master should have done a Donald Trump and just said, "You're fired. Go now." But he doesn't. He says, "You're fired in, what, 3 or 4 weeks' time? You've got 3 or 4 weeks to sort out my accounts for me. And then you're gone." And that's the whole point of the parable. He knows in a few weeks' time he's going to be jobless and homeless. He's just got these 3 or 4 weeks, however long it was, to act now to sort out his future. And I do reckon he's a bit of a North Shore kind of guy. See what he says in verse 3? "I'm not strong enough to dig. I don't do manual labor. Hard work is not my thing. And I'm too ashamed to beg," verse 3. "What am I going to do? I'm going to be jobless. I'm going to be homeless. My reputation is shot." And then he has his kind of eureka moment in verse 4. He says, "Ah, I know what I'll do. I've got this scheme and this plan so that when I'm out of a job and when I'm homeless, I'll make friends who will welcome me to their homes." And so what he does, he's a bit of a dodgy guy, isn't he? One by one, he gets in all his master's debtors, verse 5. He says to the first one, verse 5, "How much do you owe my master?" 100 measures of olive oil. Just he grasped that. That's 1,000 gallons of olive oil. That's about 5 years' wages. And on the spot, he goes, "Oh, I'll give you 50% off. 2.5 years' wages saved." I love the word in verse 6 where he says, "Sit down quickly, like 50. You can always spot the con man and say, "Sign on now, come on. Sign on to the line right now. The next one comes in, verse 7. "How much do you owe?" He says, "100 measures of wheat." That's an even larger debt, actually. That's about 15 years' wages. He says, "Oh, I'll give you 20% off." "Right, 80. And do you see how you kind of got these two people now who the manager has done them a favor? They owe him one, if you want. And so when the manager is out of work and he's homeless, these men will say, "Well, you know, he saved us 2.5 years' wages, and he saved us 3 years' wages. He's shrewd, isn't he?" The word that's used in verse 5 is the word astute. Verse 8, sorry, astute. The rich master praised the unrighteous manager because he acted astutely or shrewdly. He was kind of prudent about thinking about his future or planning for his future. He's not praised for his dishonesty. He's not praised for the embezzlement. He's praised for being shrewd. I'm sure the master did not appreciate being ripped off. And the surprise comes in verse 8, doesn't it? Jesus said this, "The sons of this age," that is, the people who don't claim to know Jesus, the people of this world, they're more astute than the Christians, the sons of the light, in dealing with their own people. The surprising advice is Jesus kind of saying, "Come on, church. Come on, church, learn from the world." He's not saying be worldly. He's not saying be dishonest. He's not saying embezzle people. He's saying, look what the world does. The world out there, they are thinking about their future. They're planning their retirement homes, and they're planning their retirement packages, and they're doing their scheming and their clever schemes to try and make money to provide for their future. But you Christians, you're clueless. If we Christians, we people are actually planned for our future with the same diligence, with the same single-mindedness, then perhaps we would be shrewd or astute. Except, we're not just planning for our superannuation, are we? And we're not just planning for our retirement, are we? What are we supposed to be planning for? Eternity? Heaven? That day when we actually get to see Jesus? That's the only certainty, isn't it? The word used in verse 9 is eternal dwellings. He's talking about that time when you meet your Maker, you see Jesus face to face, you're welcomed home. And that future that you and I have is not about which retirement village we can go into or which overseas cruise we can go on. It's about whether we are being strategic with our time and our possessions and our decisions and our money and the friends that we make today in light of eternity. Now, you know this. You know that you can't take your house with you, don't you? But you can take people with you. And you know that you can't take all your stuff and your possessions with you, but you can take people with you. And you know you can't take all those photos that sit in your computer of all those amazing overseas holidays you did. You can't take them with you. But you can take people with you, can't you? And now do you understand verse 9? Jesus said, "I tell you, make friends for yourselves by means of the unrighteous money." That is the world, the thing called money, the worldly thing called money. Money's not bad. It just belongs to this age. Make friends for yourself here so that they may welcome you into eternal dwellings. Make friends for yourself now who will be with you in eternity, so when you get there, they'll be there to welcome you home. He He says, have this mindset that today and tomorrow and next month, I'm planning for eternity. So every second of every day, I've got a chance to save a soul for Christ. I feel like I'm laboring, but if the unbelievers used every imaginable approach to secure their temporary future, why are we not more innovative and more shrewd with what can we do today to win somebody, to win a soul for Christ, to win a friend for Jesus, so that when we get there in eternity, they'll be there with us? I'm really conscious this could be an easy sermon to guilt trip you on. Because let's be honest, we know that we don't think about heaven every day. And we know we don't allow the things of eternity to really shape every conversation and what we say and what we read and the people that we help. And so it would be easy to manipulate and to feel guilty about that. But the way that we're going to live in light of eternity is have such a confidence and such a joy of heaven that it's just on our mind all the time. Remember the Apostle Paul who said, "No, I long to depart and to be with Christ, which is better by far." He called himself a citizen of heaven, not just a citizen of Kirribilli or Australia, but a citizen of heaven. Or like the Apostle John, who said his name was written in a book of life. And when you live with that mindset that I belong to heaven, my name's in the book of life, and when you know that, then you might just use your time and your talents and your speech and your money differently. I want to talk a bit about money this morning. We don't talk a lot about money at this church. If you're here for the first time, we don't talk about money all the time. But Jesus is saying this parable, he talks about money. You see that in verse 9? Make friends for heaven by means of the unrighteous money, so that when your money fails, those people, those souls will be there to welcome you in heaven. Remember the Pharisees, verse 14, who are lovers of money? And what Jesus is saying in this parable is that your view of heaven, your view of the future, will shape the way you spend your money today. Again, money is a good thing, created by God. But you know that money can be a real blessing or a real curse. Money can be an amazing resource to serve God or to serve other people, or it can be a real danger of self-indulgence. It's just coins, it's just notes, but if you have enough money, it's powerful, isn't it? Again, I find verse 9 fascinating. He uses the word unrighteous in verse 9. It's not evil, he's just saying it belongs to this world. He said in verse 9, it will fail. The currency has a use-by date. You can't take your money with you. Again, you know that. You've heard the story so many times about the really, really wealthy person who died, and someone came to the vicar at the funeral and says, how much did he leave? And he said, he left everything. They always do. But you've got to live with that mindset. You leave it all behind. And Jesus is saying, be wise and be practical and innovative with the way that you use your wealth now in light of eternity to win people for Jesus. I love this quote from an older Christian man. He says, life is pretty short, at least for me. I don't have much time left. But eternity is eternity. This thing that we called life has just flown by in a blink of an eye. And the longer I live, the less meaning anything has that's going to be left here. And the more meaning everything has that purchases friends for eternity. So on that final day when my life ends and I'm separated from all this stuff I have, I want to find people who are standing at the edge of heaven welcome me home as a friend. What a gift the Lord has given me. Just a bit more time and a bit more money and a bit more opportunity to win souls for Jesus. Love that. I hope you know that your money just belongs to God anyway. See that in verse 12? If you haven't been faithful with what belonged to someone else, it belongs to God. You're just stewards if you want. At the ATM service, every week we say a prayer. He goes, all things come from you, O Lord, and of your own have we given you. All things belong to God, and we're just giving back to God. I read a really depressing obituary about a millionaire. These are the words used. He was a sad, lonely millionaire. He was a sad, lonely millionaire. Had so much, but had no friends. All I'm saying is that knowing about heaven, knowing that future date when you meet your Maker, it will change the way you spend your money today. So be generous. That's verse 9. Make friends for heaven. He's not saying go down a pub or buy your friends a round of drinks. He's saying make sure that you invest your money in gospel stuff. You can't send your gadgets up, but you can send people up. So whilst you have money at your disposal, whilst you're still living and breathing, think wisely as to what you do with it. Has anyone here ever heard of a lady called Lady Huntington? I've talked about her before. She's a wealthy, she was a really, 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 really wealthy woman in the UK. Born into a rich, wealthy, aristocratic family. She became a Christian, age 22. And for the next 50 years, she spent all her money holding dinner parties, lavish dinner parties. But she held lavish dinner parties to invite all her rich, wealthy friends who did not yet know Jesus. And at every dinner party, she had a minister there who would just talk about Jesus. As she describes it, almost at every dinner party, someone gave their life to Christ. She built churches, she built chapels, she paid for mission work. And as she got towards her deathbed, as she aged, she was running out of money. So what did she do? She sold her jewelry. And she sold her jewelry to host more dinner parties, to tell the gospel, and to build more chapels so more people could hear about Jesus. And she died almost penniless. But there'd be thousands of people in heaven because of her. What a great example she is. You ever thought about the person or the people who actually donated to build this building? You know, in 1884, people gave lots and lots of money so that we can sit here today and people can come in here week after week after week and hear about Jesus because they're thinking about people's souls, not just thinking about the here and now. A really good friend of mine who's now in the UK who kind of flies here back and forth from Sydney, who does that? Works in Sydney, lives in England. He's a billionaire. He's a billionaire. And he funds, you know, countless gospel ministries throughout the whole world. And there'll be thousands of people in heaven because of him. You've heard of people like John Wesley. He worked out as a young man that he needed about £28 a year to live on. And so when he earned £30, he kept £28 and gave away two. And when he earned £60, he kept £28 and gave away 32. And when he earned £100, he kept the £28 and gave all the rest away to gospel work. There's a lady at my last church in London, who her name was Brenda. And she was widowed quite tragically, but she was very wealthy. And so what did she do? She said, I don't need to live in a five-bedroom house in Hampstead. I'm going to sell this house and I'm going to buy a one-bedroom unit. And she just gave it all away. Yes, she gave it to her kids. Of course she did. But she funded gospel ministry. And she came to church one night and she just handed me a check. And I just opened this check for the church. And like, she was crying. And I was like, whoa, what is that? And she had tears in her eyes. She said, look, God's been so good to me. I just want people to be there for eternity. Just use it wisely to win souls for Jesus. And I am thankful for the generosity of people here. People who really do give their money generously so the gospel can go out. I sent an email out 10 days ago now, just asking for about 40 people if they could give towards the Websters, really, as they plan to go on the mission field. Within hours, people have given. Thank you for that. But the reality is that there are some incredibly, incredibly generous people. But if my maths is right, that the average person still spends more money on one meal out or just buying a takeaway coffee every day than they give the church each week. In Lent this year, I stopped buying takeaway coffees for the whole of Lent. I buy about one a day. And I just gave all that money to the gospel ministry. And I was just shocked. I was actually shocked by the amount of money just in the course of Lent that could give away by not having a takeaway coffee every day. Money will not last, but souls will last. So make sure you use it to win friends for eternity. And then be responsible. The principle's there in verse 10. Whoever's faithful in very little is also faithful in much. But whoever is unrighteous in very little is also unrighteous in much. So if you haven't been faithful with the unrighteous money, who will trust you with what's genuine? The very little in verse 10 is actually money. He's saying money is just very little. It's not important in life. Money is a little thing. There's lots more important things in life, like people and godliness and eternity. So if you've been faithful with very little, then God will entrust you with much. Again, I love this story. It's a story of a pastor. It's not me. A parishioner came to his pastor and said, look, I don't have much money at the moment. When I've got more money, I will give more. And the pastor said to him, no, you won't. When you've got more money, you'll just spend more. And he took him to this verse and said, you know, faithfulness has nothing to do with how much you have. Faithfulness is about your heart and your attitudes. And he's right, isn't it? It doesn't matter whether you're earning $5,000 a year or whether you're earning $500,000. Faithfulness means whatever God has given you, you're faithful with that. Because if I read these verses rightly, what Jesus is saying is that the way that we use our money is a sign of our spiritual maturity. Now you do those spiritual checkups, you ask questions about how's your Bible reading, how's your prayer life, how's your godliness, what sins are you fighting at the moment. How often does anyone say to you, how are you using your money at the moment? How are you using your money at the moment? And the Bible is right, the love of money is the root of a lot of evil. As we strive for more and more and more and more, become more and more powerful and more godless. I said, serve God, not money. We know verse 13 is true, we just don't like it. We know verse 13 is true, but we think that we are different. We think we can be the exception. He says, no household slave can be the slave of two masters. You've only got one master. You'll either hate one and love the other, or be devoted to one and despise the other. And you cannot, it's impossible to be slaves of both God and money. And you know that's true, don't you? You know that if you start to serve money and find your identity in money, the house that you live in, the clothes that you wear, the car that you drive, the schools that your kids go to, all the stuff and stuff and stuff, you build bigger and bigger storage places. Isn't it ridiculous that you've got storage units? We can't fit into our house until we hire a storage unit to put more stuff in that we never see. That wasn't in my notes, it just came to me. But it's the reality that we're serving money. Money becomes our master. And we start to buy, you know, $700 sunglasses, and our excuse is, well, I couldn't find any that really suited me. We work longer and longer hours, and we define ourselves by what we wear and the house that we live in. And I fear we're becoming slaves to money. And that's the Pharisees, isn't it? They loved money, verse 14. And so they sneered at Jesus when he talks about using what you've got now in light of eternity. Don't you find verse 14 extraordinary? They are face to face with the Messiah. They are face to face with Jesus the Messiah, and they still think that money is more important. Except it's not that extraordinary, is it? Because every week we're here at church and we're face to face with Jesus and we're singing songs about the cross and we're talking about Jesus all the time, and then we walk out of this church building and money becomes our master again. I want to be really honest, church by the bridge could be a place where it's potentially dangerous, because money can be an idol. I want to finish today by just imagining. Just imagine what we could do for Kirribilli and Sydney in terms of winning souls for Christ if we left here with a slightly different attitude to money. Just imagine it when your next paycheck comes in. You don't think, oh, I can afford to go to that restaurant. Instead of going to that restaurant, I'm going to give that money away to gospel ministry. Just imagine what we could do for this diocese and for this city and for this country if every Christian took this parable seriously, that we were living now in light of eternity and we were giving now in light of eternity. I'm not asking money for church. I'm asking you to use your money to serve the kingdom and to serve the King, to win friends, to win people, whatever way that God's going to give you, equip you to do that, but to win friends for eternity, because you're living now with your eyes fixed on eternity, because that's the only secure thing that you know about your future, isn't it? See, when you know the future, it changes how you live today, doesn't it? I'm going to give us a time just to reflect. And then we're going to say a confession. And then we're going to get an open prayer. And this morning, can I urge you and plead with you just to stand up and pray. And just pray for generosity. Pray for gospel ministry. Pray for people to run for Christ. Just pray that the gospel goes out in this city and this country and this world. And just pray that in eternity there will be people there who are there because of you and because of the generosity of others. So a moment by yourself, and then we'll confess, and then we'll have a time of open prayer.